So welcome to the 1:30 session on the next to last day of Mises U. We're going to talk about consumer product regulation. We're going to talk about regulation of goods. We're going to talk about regulation of services. We'll talk about regulation of inputs into the production process. And then we'll use economics to analyze the regulatory structure itself. So if you've been in some of my other lectures, or if you didn't sleep through the first one, then you'll know that one thing I've been thinking about a lot recently is the knowledge problem. How do you know? And then further, might it follow from the existence of a market failure that the government can do anything to fix it? Again, not necessarily a question of my libertarian preferences, but a question of my analytical economics. Let's begin with a story. Thank you. It's the 1950s. There's a toy company in Wisconsin called the Marlin Toy Company. The Marlin Toy Company produces two products, well, among others, but they produce two products. One's called Birdie Ball, the other is called Flutter Ball. Okay, these are little plastic balls that have little rattly stuff inside them, so that, you know, babies bat them around the floor and they rattle, and the babies will, like, gurgle and coo and do whatever babies do when they're really excited about something. They produce Birdie Ball and Flutter Ball. The regulators say, hey, Birdie Ball and Flutter Ball are both dangerous, because if they break, they pop out these little pellets. Babies could swallow the pellets, they could choke on the pellets, all sorts of terrible things could happen. Therefore, we're going to ban Birdie Ball and Flutter Ball. You need to fix this product if you're going to be allowed to market it in the United States. The Marlin Toy Company says, okay, sure, we'll do that. They go, they redesign Birdie Ball, they redesign Flutter Ball so that it meets federal guidelines. They reintroduce the product into the market. The Consumer Product Safety Commission has, during the interim, taken charge of regulating consumer products for safety. They produce their banned list, their list of products that are banned. On this list, erroneously, are Birdie Ball and Flutter Ball. So even though these products meet federal guidelines, they're both on the list of outlawed products. The Marlin Toy Company brings this to the attention of the regulators. They say, hey, you've printed this list of banned products that has our Birdie Ball and Flutter Ball on it. That's not correct. The Consumer Product Safety Commission says, yeah, we're not about to withdraw 250,000 copies of this list just for two little products. This destroyed the Marlin Toy Company. And the great irony of it is that the Consumer Product Safety Commission, charged with ensuring the integrity and quality of products available to consumers, refused to recall its own defective product, even though its own defective product, in fact, actually destroyed the company. So that's where we're going when we think about regulation. And it doesn't just affect for-profit entities. So consider this question about safe. Safe. Safe versus unsafe. We like things that are safe, okay? But being people who are engaged in the economic way of thinking, we know that what do we know about people's decisions? They're made at the margin, right? Very good. Excellent. I like that people make decisions at the margin. People respond to incentives. That's what I go for in Econ 101, is I turn people into, you know, drones who spout crap about supply curves and demand curves. It's wonderful. So people make decisions at the margin. The question, obviously, is what is safe? What is unsafe? And when we give people the right, or when we give people the prerogative to decide that something is safe or unsafe, this can have consequences. A couple of evenings ago, Professor Holzman mentioned the Foundation for Economic Education. How many of y'all have been to FEE? Okay, so a handful of people have been to FEE. How many of y'all are going to FEE next week? Okay, all right, so people are on the Libertarian Austrian Economics Tour of North America. IHS, Mises, FEE. There's an entrepreneurial opportunity here. Someone needs to print tour T-shirts. You know, I was there. Be like the band. You know, the Cure Mood Swings tour that they did in what, 1996 or something. It's the last T-shirt I bought at a concert. Shows like all the cities they've been to. Be like, yeah, you know, the Libertarian Austrian Economics North American Tour, you know, Mises Institute, IHS, FEE, Independent Institute, so on and so forth. Maybe you should get like a special pin if you go to all of them. Okay, but so back to FEE. I was talking with some of you probably know Larry White. Know Larry White or know of Larry White. He teaches at FEE periodically, and he was telling me about how at their facility at FEE, which is this grand, old, beautiful mansion in Irvington, New York, wonderful, wonderful old place. It's where Mises met Rothbard, I think, and all sorts of wonderful things happened. They used to house students on site. They can't do that anymore because the local authority said that one of the staircases in one of the places where they house students was too narrow to prevent people from escaping in the event of a fire. That shouldn't be a problem. They could fix it. But the historical preservation authorities said, since this is a historical building, you're not allowed to modify it. So they're caught in the ultimate catch-22, where now they're kind of a slave to the property. So if you go to fee, you can take a picture of it and be like, this is deadweight loss right before my eyes. We have potential gains from trade that are not being exploited, and so on and so forth. Okay, so if one regulatory agency saying you can't use this, another regulatory agency saying you can't fix it, all to the detriment of the world in which we live. To which someone might respond, oh, but you crass economist, you need to put people before profits. People before profits. And this sounds noble, does it not? Put people before profits. Well, we put people before profits, and if fee can't house people on site, if they have people in for conferences, what do they have to do? Okay, they might have to hire an expensive hotel, so they might have to use resources paying a hotel. How do they get people from point A to point B? Taxis, stuff like that. They probably have to drive them around. Okay, my guess is that the risk of a gory death in a taxi in Irvington, New York, or being on the road in Irvington, New York, is probably much greater than the risk of dying in a fire at fee. Okay, so the unintended consequence of this policy might actually be to raise the risk to the people who would otherwise be in a position to bear it. Okay? So even if we put, there's no such thing as putting people before profits. You know, in a well-functioning market economy, you earn profits by serving people. Let's consider another example. Things that are safe versus things that are unsafe. Another one of my favorite examples is the ladder. Okay. So I have here a ladder. I hunted all over the institute to find this. I mean, it's more like a little step stool than it is a ladder. And these things are incredibly dangerous. Okay? Dude, seriously. Whoa. This may be a much better example than I was planning for it to be. Okay, so ladders are dangerous. And the government regulates them. Also, they have all sorts of safety standards for ladders and step stools and things like that. Okay? Why? Because if you fall off a ladder and break your neck, that could be bad. And of course, the ladder companies, Costco, COSCO. yeah, exactly. Right. And yeah, and then everybody's gonna learn the wrong lesson. But see, when I fall and break my neck, they say, oh, well, clearly we need more regulation. You know, because otherwise this horrible thing wouldn't have happened. All right? Okay, so they say, well, we need to raise the standards for these ladders to say, well, you can't sell it unless it meets these safety criteria. Okay? What's this going to do to the cost of ladders? It's going to raise it, right? Okay, so ladders get more expensive. Again, though, they say, well, so what? People before profits, right? Okay? So you have to pay an extra $5, $10, $20, et cetera, good grief, et cetera, for a ladder. What's the big deal? Well, one thing that we know in economics, demand curves slope downward. And furthermore, if you raise the price of something, people look for substitutes. So what's a substitute for a ladder?
Watermelon.
Hmm? A watermelon. All right? A watermelon's a very bad substitute for a ladder. Okay? And like I said, I'm scared to think about like 2 a.m. after an evening of festivities, someone picking up that ball and running with it. All right? Okay, so a chair might be something that is a substitute for a ladder. Okay? Now, which is more dangerous, a chair or a ladder? If you want to change a light bulb or something like that, which is likely more dangerous, this or one of those? The chair, right? Okay, how many of you guys want to see me climb a chair? Okay? Too bad. Okay? Because given the shakiness of the ladder a second ago, I was going to do the whole stand in a chair thing, but now, you know, I'm old and fat, so I don't know if it would actually support my weight, and it's relatively risky. So what we expect to happen to the rate at which people injure themselves in falls and crashes and stuff if we raise safety regulations on ladders? Goes up, right? Okay. So we see more injuries because people who need to change light bulbs, instead of standing on ladders, they stand on chairs, they stand on tables. And things like that. One more example. Babies on planes. In the event of a plane crash, if you're holding a baby in your lap, would you expect the baby to survive? Absolutely not. Right, because you're hitting the water at 600 miles, or the ground, at 600 miles an hour. It's probably not physically impossible, but exceptionally unlikely that you're going to be able to hold on to the kid. Okay, so the kid's going to fly through the plane and die. In the 1980s, I think it was the 80s, the Federal Aviation Administration considered passing a law saying if you're going to have a baby on a plane, that baby has to have a car seat, a plane seat, and that baby has to have a ticket. It's great, right? If it saves one life, it's worth it, is it not? No. Who said no? Someone said no. I heard no over here. You said no. All right, so I'm going to make sure I get you on record here. Okay, how do you pronounce your name?
Loda.
Loda? Okay, sorry. Loda.
Loda Kassash.
Loda Kassash from?
Belgium.
From Belgium, from the University of Antwerp in Belgium?
Yep.
Okay, so Loda Kassash from the University of Antwerp in Belgium has said no. He has said that it is not worth it if we save one life.
Even more,
okay. Please, again, for the record.
Because you kill seven more, true to estimates of Thomas Sowell in his book.
As far as I know.
Okay. Because for every baby that you save, allegedly you kill seven more. So one baby doesn't die in a plane crash, but seven babies just magically die, right? Not magically, okay. Yes. People look for substitutes. If you raise the cost of flying, and if you're talking about, like, say, a family of three having to buy a plane ticket for a baby, you're talking about a 50% increase in the cost of flying. They're going to substitute away from flying and toward driving, which is much more dangerous. Much more dangerous than flying. And indeed, economists, were able to deep six this by showing, or by estimating, that for every one baby saved in a plane crash, seven babies would die on the highways. So fortunately, here's a regulation in which it was decided that safe isn't necessarily always and everywhere what it's cracked up to be. Let's consider some other regulations designed to help people. What kind of people, Derek? People who need help. That reference must be a little bit dated now. Anybody seen Zoolander? Okay, wow. I'm going to end the lecture and go cry. No. Okay? So we want to help people. We want to help people who need help. In the city of Memphis, where I live, our city, I think it was the city council, decided in their infinite wisdom that, well, what they need to do is for poor people who live in Memphis, they live in relatively drafty, energy-inefficient places. Okay? They spend a lot of money on power as a result. They decided that, quote, low-income housing now has to meet certain standards for energy efficiency. Okay? Who wins? Who loses? What's going to happen to all this low-income housing? Yeah, it's going to get more expensive. It's not going to be low-income housing for much longer. So raising the cost of doing something means people are going to do less of it. People are going to convert low-income housing into high-income housing, or they're just going to leave the market, or any variety of other things. And in a lot of cases, attempts to regulate products for the benefit of consumers is not really going to work out so well. If you went to Walter Block's lecture this morning, he talked about the FDA. He talked about regulation of food, regulation of drugs, and the regulatory infrastructure. Thalidomide in the 1950s was a morning sickness pill that had been approved in Germany. They started using it in the United States, and it caused all sorts of horrendous birth defects. It had passed muster, apparently. And as a result, unfortunately, and again I'm going to repeat something Professor Block said, the FDA didn't go out of business. They said, hey, this product is safe. It wasn't. The FDA didn't go out of business. In fact, the FDA got greater discretion and a bigger budget as a result. With what impact on people going forward? With what impact on the rate of development of new drugs? Lower. Right, so we get less innovation. We get more expensive drugs, and the most recent estimate I saw, one of the glories of the internet is that you can fact check me on this. I believe someone estimated it's either 1,600 people a day, or 1,600 people a week, or 1,600 people a month, or 1,600 people a year who die, something to do with 1,600, who die waiting for drugs and medical procedures that are going through FDA approval. Right, so regulation designed to make things safe, almost always leads us into unintended consequences that suggest that the law is not going to do what we want it to do, not what we expect it to do, and may often do exactly the opposite of what we think we're going to do. Okay, so those are a couple of examples of the market for goods. Question from the back. Okay? Okay, so there's an epistemological problem with regulation. And I'm going to punt to the end of the discussion, because we're going to discuss that a little bit and perhaps in some detail. Okay. All right, so that's the market for goods. Let's consider, too, the market for services. The market for services is very heavily regulated. In a paper in Econ Journal Watch that came out, I think, in the last issue, Frank Stevenson from Berry College and one of his students pointed out that labor economics textbooks consider the minimum wage in great detail. They don't really consider regulation of professions and occupations, in spite of the fact that I think there are now far more occupations that are subject to regulation than are subject to the minimum wage. So we have standards for the workplace. We have the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which can conduct no-knock raids on workplaces. If you tip someone off that OSHA is coming, you go to jail. And we can see some of the effects of these regulations on the world that we live in. So, who's better off as a result of workplace safety regulations? Government? Okay. Special interest groups? People who work for those agencies? Okay. Companies that aren't regulated? Companies that are big enough to handle the cost, yeah? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Lawyers, companies that produce the goods that are necessary for compliance. Engineers who re-engineer the products. Economists who give talks on it. Right. I don't know what you're insinuating.
Art Carden is a cartel.
A cartel of one.
Yes.
Okay. You're like army commercials, maybe. Yes. One more. Would insurance companies benefit from that? Maybe so. A priori, I'm not sure. Now then, there's one group that no one has mentioned yet. Huh? Okay, the regulated people, the people who are regulated, some of them might benefit. Okay? This is a room full of people who apparently have studied a lot of economics. Okay? Why? Because? The workplace itself. Well, who's the workplace? Right. Okay? Okay, the company might be... Huh? The companies are the workers that the regulations are intended to protect. Okay, so they clearly are made better off, right? No. Okay, well, I remember taking a high school math class one time, and a guy from OSHA showed up to inspect our classroom to make sure that my high school math teacher was not working in an unsafe environment. And I remember him standing there. I think he had a tape recorder and a notepad, and he was scribbling furiously and speaking softly into his tape recorder. Maybe he didn't have a tape recorder. It makes for a better story, though. Scribbling furiously or something like that about the bottle of hand lotion on my math teacher's desk. Okay, to make absolutely sure that this lotion wasn't going to kill anybody or something like that. So the argument, as it goes, is we need workplace safety regulation to protect the workers. Okay, but we know, or we can reasonably infer, that's probably not true. Why? How can the market process ensure that people get the combination of safety and wages that they want? Some people are going to prefer a very, very safe work environment. Some people are going to be willing to accept greater risks in exchange for higher wages. When you become an academic, okay, as some of you no doubt will, okay, trust me, we don't do this for the money. Okay? And we don't do it for the rock star lifestyle. Okay? Rather, we're willing to accept a combination of wages and non-wage benefits. Those non-wage benefits being that we get to hang out with people like you and talk about things we find interesting. Okay? So there's no a priori way to know what the right level of safety is. There's no a priori way to know what combinations of wages and benefits and workplace safety and all sorts of other stuff people are going to demand. Therefore, there's no way for the regulators to know how they should regulate. I know that Austrians don't really believe in indifference curves that much, but indifference curve analysis can be useful in some contexts. You can use it to illustrate the point that that by having workplace safety regulations, you don't change the welfare of people who want a lot of workplace safety, but you lower the welfare of people who don't want a lot of workplace safety. People who are willing to accept a slightly less safe workplace in exchange for higher wages. Let's consider a couple of other examples of regulated workplaces. To be an interior designer in some places, in Alabama, I believe, requires certain licenses. Okay? I wrote a Mises article about this one time and engaged in an act of civil disobedience by offering interior design recommendations on behalf of myself as an economist in an article for the Mises Institute. Now, I'm an economist working at a school in Tennessee. I wrote the article from a friend's basement in West Virginia, and I sent it to a research institute in Alabama. So clearly, this is interstate commerce that requires some type of federal regulation. Let's try to construct a plausible story for why we might want to regulate interior design. To protect people from bad fashion sense. Okay? Or to protect people from being gauche. Well, can we do it? Probably not. Who benefits? Incumbent interior designers, because if you prevent the supply of design services from increasing, this is going to increase the rent, or this is going to increase the additional income that current interior designers are going to be able to extract. We're going to talk about a pathology of this here in just a second. Flower arranging in Louisiana. If you want to be a certified flower arranger in Louisiana, you have to take an incredibly difficult test with a very low pass rate. Okay? In fact, people have taken this test, have failed it, and some of the examiners have said, hey, you did a really good job. Why don't you come work at my shop? Okay? So this once again imposes a special burden on the potential consumers and producers of goods and services that are not, unfortunately, going to be able to be traded on the market. So why don't courts do something to stop this? Why don't judges do something to stop this? I taught at an Institute for Humane Studies summer seminar a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago now, and one of my co-faculty members was Robert McNamara, a lawyer for the Institute for Justice, and he gave a very interesting and excellent talk about the specific legal theory under which all this stuff passes muster. And apparently a lot of judges are looking at this and saying, well, hey, who are we to judge? Think about that for a second. Judges saying, well, who are we to judge? I don't know, you tell me. saying, well, there might be some plausible reason why the regulators would regulate. Public safety. You know, you arrange flowers badly and transmit some sort of germs, and therefore we need to have this, you know, these types of regulations. Okay? Once again, though, the people who win are the incumbent firms. The people who lose are their consumers and their potential competitors. Great moments in the history of civil disobedience. Look this up on YouTube. A member of the Free State Project in New Hampshire, some of you might have seen this, heroically, on the lawn of the board of the New Hampshire Board of Cosmetology, gave a manicure without a license. Okay? So you can go on YouTube, you can watch him giving the manicure, and you can watch the cops showing up to arrest him. Okay? All right, so the winners in all of this are presumably the incumbents. The losers are their potential competitors and their customers. The real winners, though, are the people who work for the state. Because what's going to happen is if you can create the possibility of a rent transfer, of a transfer of resources from one group of people to another group of people, then people are going to expend resources trying to get their hands on that transfer. I mentioned, I think it was a couple of days ago, that spending at fancy restaurants and golf courses around Washington, D.C. tends to skyrocket when major legislation comes up. Okay? So all of the potential transfer is going to be dissipated through the rent-seeking process, such that not only are we no better off, we're all universally worse off as a result of having this rent-seeking infrastructure. So, insanity of a sort, these plausible rationales for government regulation lead to losses for pretty much everybody involved. If you've ever seen the movie War Games, they say, well, the only way to win is not to play, but you're always going to have an incentive to enter. So, at a meta level, the question is not, I think, necessarily how do we have efficient regulations, but how do we prevent regulation from emerging in the first place so that we don't tip into this large-scale rent-seeking equilibrium. Well, how would markets regulate themselves? Profit and loss. Okay.
Accreditation.
Yeah, accreditation agencies. Okay, consumer reports, things like that. I've got a secret. They do already do this. I have a personal secret, a confession, as it were. I'm not a licensed economist. In fact, none of the faculty members at MisesU are licensed economists. There'll be a check waiting for you at the front desk. Okay. Right? None of us are licensed economists. Tom Woods, are you a licensed historian? Tom Woods is not a licensed historian. I'm sorry. But, so clearly the market has failed. You cannot trust the instruction you've received this week. Is this true? Yes. Okay. All right. So some people are saying yes. Okay. Well, I like to think the answer is no. Okay, because there's an array of signals that we can send, an array of signals we can accumulate to suggest that maybe we know something about economics. Writing, PhDs, all sorts of stuff. I trust Thomas, in spite of his lack of a license, I trust that Thomas Woods knows what he's talking about when he's writing about history, because I've read some of his stuff. He has a PhD from an excellent institution. Okay, so the market itself will generate certification mechanisms that'll tell us whether you should trust people or not. So the American Medical Association, in spite of being kind of a rent-seeking interest group, and the American Academy of Pediatrics, which does more or less the same thing, might be able to play a greater social role by serving as a certification agency. Say, this person is an AMA-approved doctor, this other person is not. Let's consider what happens when we drive transactions underground. How efficient is the market for kidneys? If you want to buy a kidney, who do you have to talk to? His name's probably Guido. That would be my guess. Or Vinny. Or something like that. Okay? If you get sold a bad kidney, you've engaged in an illegal transaction, you've got no claim against the person who sold you the bad kidney. Same story for illegal drugs. Okay? If I go to Tumors Drugs here down the corner and I buy aspirin and that aspirin makes me sick, what do? I sue the aspirin company. Okay, if I go behind Tumors Drugs at a certain time of night and buy another product which might be illicit, and that product makes me sick, who do I sue? Nobody. Okay, so in relatively unregulated markets, in which the goods being transacted are legal, we can expect lots and lots and lots and lots of organizations to emerge that will certify quality. The Underwriters Laboratory, for example. If you pick up almost any consumer electronic device, flip it over, you'll see a little seal that says UL. Okay? The Underwriters Laboratory is a private organization that certifies consumer electronics and says, hey, this is legit. This is good stuff. We will put our good name on this product and certify that it works. There is, unfortunately, no Underwriters Laboratory for crack. There is no Underwriters Laboratory for prostitutes. There's no Underwriters Laboratory for all of the stuff that gets traded in illegal markets, so the people with a comparative advantage in fraud, with a comparative advantage in violence, and with a comparative advantage in all sorts of nasty stuff are going to be the people who are going to tend to be attracted to that market. Okay? So regulating stuff reduces welfare. Making stuff illegal reduces welfare. Now let's consider, someone mentioned the epistemological problem that regulators have a little bit ago. Okay, so let's consider whether the government should intervene in the case of market failure. Some of you might be following the Henry Louis Gates saga. Okay, and this is something that's relevant to me as someone who is interested in the economics of race and someone who's interested in this question about whether having a monopoly provider of police services is a good idea. Okay, so some things that we know about the Gates case is Mr. Gates was in his own home. He was there legally. He was arrested. Does Gates have the option of taking his protection services elsewhere? No, he doesn't. Let's consider another example. Recently, a Boston police officer was suspended pending a termination hearing for sending an email to members of his National Guard unit and some other Boston police officers. Okay, part of the story says, and this is a quote from the email, quote, or had he, quote, been the officer he verbally assaulted like a banana-eating jungle monkey, I would have sprayed him in the face with OC, oleoresin capsicum, or pepper spray, deserving of his belligerent noncompliance, end quote. So you have here someone charged to serve and protect, who in an email compares, uses a racial slur against Henry Louis Gates three times, refers to a story, I believe it was in the Boston Globe, as, quote, jungle monkey gibberish, end quote. Okay, so this is a guy with what I would call, at the very least, antisocial preferences, apparently. Okay. And then he says, had he been the guy in charge, or had he been the cop in question, he would have assaulted a man in his own home for speaking out, for protesting, for failure to comply. That's a guy who needs a badge and a gun. Okay. So, it's a non sequitur to go from market failure to the government can fix it. And further, the guy was simply suspended. He's fighting his suspension, in part perhaps because of police unions, in part too because it's very, very difficult to fire someone. Not only can Gates not take his business elsewhere, the cops are going to have probably a little bit of difficulty getting rid of this guy when evidence from the, and granted this is one of these stories that's sort of blown up and been sensationalized, the evidence suggests that, yeah, he probably should have been fired immediately. Had your hand up there, and you have a laptop, so I'm assuming that you're fact-checking me. Okay. Yeah, I was looking at it about an hour ago or so, and they said pending a termination hearing. So they definitely want to fire him, that's for sure. But they're probably not as flexible as they would be were the labor market not regulated the way that it is, and they would be much more responsive to the wants and needs of their consumers than they would be, they would be much more responsive to the wants and needs of their consumers, like Henry Louis Gates, like you, like me, if the market were far more competitive.
Okay.
While there is some research to suggest, perhaps, that not all regulation is always and everywhere a bad idea, there's a plausible reason to suspect that generally it works out to the benefit not of consumers, but to the benefit of producers and politicians. Okay? And further, there's no reason to think that the market can't take care of it. Okay? You might have seen the Apple commercials where it says there's an app for that. In pretty much any situation, we might say, well, can the market fix this? Well, there's a market for that. What about information? There's a market for that. What about non-racist police services? Well, there would be a market for that. We'd like to think that there would be a market for that. What about good drugs? Good aspirin. There'd be a market for that. What about crack that won't kill you? Well, okay, in the limit, there might be a market for that as well. Okay. So all of the reasons that we have regulation are, for the most part, superfluous. It's difficult to identify the information we would need in order to regulate effectively, to regulate rationally, and moreover, the incentives facing the people who are doing the regulating or facing the people who are doing all of the protecting outside of the market process, it's far from clear that those incentives are consistent with the creation of value, with the protection of people, and with the doing of justice. So that's a handful of things that we've talked about on consumer product regulation, consumer safety, and the relationship between the state and the market. We've got 20 minutes now, I think. Happy to take any questions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because it engages the governments more, don't mind getting sick,
right.
I can make a choice. But how about those under wanting to dump this and mm-hmm. ruin their life?
Okay.
You think it would be wise for government to...
Okay. So, given that people are going to make a lot of stupid mistakes, and given particularly that children may not be entirely rational, would it not be wise for the government to regulate and say, you can't sell alcohol, say, to anyone who's under 21, you can't sell cigarettes to anyone who's under 18 or 19 to try to protect the kids from themselves? You have a response to that? Okay, so regulation didn't stop Enron WorldCom, so it's not clear necessarily that regulation will accomplish those ends. That's a good answer. What do you think?
Well, those, even if, let's say, they, at least theoretically, are the thing, do you need a big government to enforce it?
Okay.
The only way, like, to sell alcohol or cigarettes is to decide that thing.
Okay, should the parents decide rather than the government? Who knows? One, two, three. I feel like a talk show host. Okay? Sorry? Okay? Okay, parents regulate minors. Okay? Okay? Okay. So markets might weed out firms, drugstores, and things like that that sell heroin derivatives to children. Okay.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. I think a lot of stores not sell to kids. Mm-hmm. It would entice more demand for, you know, oh yeah, this company's
bad. Okay. Okay. All right. So some companies might try to do quote unquote the right thing. Okay. So I have now a stack of 34 coupons for Chick-fil-A chicken minis and chicken biscuits that I gather up at lunch yesterday. I had some Chick-fil-A chicken minis for breakfast this morning. Now, one thing we know about Chick-fil-A is, in addition to the fact that they provide absolutely excellent food at reasonable prices, they're closed on Sundays for religious reasons. The founders of the company, just they don't believe in working on Sunday. The company's closed. Okay. For that reason, and others, they're very popular among people who share the same beliefs. Okay, so I would assume that, you know, the guy who's selling crack for kids is probably not going to be real popular among a lot of folks. And then you raise a very good, very interesting point, which is at what point on the continuum do we start treating people like adults? And it's not clear to me that there's any specific break point at which someone becomes a man. Or at which someone becomes a woman. A woman. Or at which someone becomes a responsible adult. So where do you draw the line? That becomes a big issue. Okay, and then also you create an illegal trade in cigarettes for kids. Okay? So, my mom smoked for a good part of her adult life. We argued about this, as kids and parents tend to do. When I was 16, I hit on a brilliant idea. I was going to start smoking. And I said, hey, Mom, I started smoking. I'm going to quit when you do. That wasn't real smart. Nicotine's one of the most addictive substances on earth. I did quit smoking. It's been actually just over 10 years ago now. Okay, but this is exactly an example of what you're thinking about. And exactly an example of some of the things that some people were saying. Okay, I made a really stupid decision, shocking as that might seem, as a teenager. At the same time, though, the laws in the state of Ohio that said don't sell tobacco to kids under 18, yeah, whatever. Okay, I can get cigarettes just about anywhere. So the laws were ineffective. It's not necessarily clear that we could fix the problem via regulation and things like that. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a very interesting point. Okay, so for those of you who are listening to this on the eventual web broadcast, so I told this story about buying cigarettes in Ohio, and one of our esteemed students has mentioned that his dad runs a store that sells cigarettes, and periodically the state of Ohio will try to sting them by sending in underage kids with fake IDs. Okay, which if I were to furnish kids with fake IDs and say, hey, go buy some cigarettes, say it's part of a research project, they would go to jail. I would go to jail. However, if the government does it, it's absolutely okay. This again gets back to the Henry Louis Gates thing and this question about whether there should be a monopolist on force and whether law should provide or should apply to the watchman. Okay? So like I said, one of the issues with this current email controversy, in addition to the violent racism of the email, was the claim that, hey, I would have assaulted this guy. You know, not just assaulted, I would have assaulted and battered this person by, like, spraying pepper spray in his eyes and things like that. Okay, so at what point, so what activities are legitimate for some people, what activities are legitimate for others? Question I can't answer right now, but worth considering. Yeah.
Cigarettes, yeah. You know, parents, mm-hmm. Well, I don't have to spend time, it's right. Legal, and by the time
you get these regular Right, so self-reliance gets destroyed because the regulation might be a substitute for education. So basically what this says is it creates moral hazard. So people don't conduct the kind of due diligence they otherwise would because they assume, hey, this has the government's seal of approval, therefore it must be healthy. Okay, now, again, paper idea for any of you looking for something to study would be to look at the relationship between changes in tobacco regulation and types of knowledge and the care with which people engage in search for good information. Okay, so a friend of mine from graduate school has written a handful of papers in which he points out that in addition to what's called the capture theory of regulation, which is what we're talking about here, by and large, which is using regulation to hamper your competitors, there's also the information asymmetry story, which is that some stuff is just very difficult to measure. And he finds some evidence to suggest that a lot of progressive era regulation is more consistent with the information asymmetry story than it is with the capture story. It's pretty provocative stuff. However, following this line of reasoning, It's not clear necessarily that the regulation is unambiguously good, because one of the things that you're doing when you get the government to regulate is you're exporting part of your responsibility, part of your search cost, onto the rest of society. Okay? So it may very well be that, yes, the regulation is consistent with the information asymmetry story, but the regulators, instead of being captured by competitors, might be captured by consumers. It's not clear that the marginal benefit of regulation is lower than the marginal cost. Other questions, comments, thoughts? 1, 2, 3.
Oh, I just wanted to self-regulate. There are several ways to, warn against fraudulent advertisement and the quality of the product. But these are brought up. And,
okay. So there are you do get the emergence of voluntary mechanisms that can and do help people acquire information about the products they're consuming. Okay, so there might be a website like RatedAll.com for prostitutes and drug dealers and things like that. During Walter Block's talk this morning, I was searching around and he was talking about the cost of heroin habits. So, using Google, I looked around and I found www.heroinhelper.com, okay, which is a website designed to help you kick your heroin habit. Okay, so the market, or kind individuals, are producing information of their own volition that presumably is reducing these problems and making us better off. Yeah. Ah, okay. Is it possible that regulation can be good? Okay. Fire codes, seat belts, auto safety glass. Let's talk about seat belts. Okay, because some of you might be familiar with the empirical work on this. Okay. Seat belts kill people. Wait, what? Seatbelts kill, okay? How? Okay? You drive faster, okay? So wearing a seatbelt will reduce the probability that you die in an accident. That much is true. It also reduces the cost of driving recklessly. People drive more recklessly, you get perhaps fewer deaths per accident, but either no change in or more highway deaths as a result of the seatbelt law and as a result of this wide variety of safety regulations. Some additional non-trivial number of people die every year as a result of corporate average fuel economy standards, which mean that cars aren't built. They don't build them like they used to. So they're built with lighter materials that break more easily. And if your car breaks more easily, that means you break more easily. Okay? Yeah.
Not all seats have internal problems, but if they are beneficial, it's about government
Right. Yeah. So the question is not always, will this make me safer? Maybe. The next question is, at what price? Am I willing to pay for that additional safety? Okay. Some of you might be familiar with the name Gordon Tullock, who, in assessing seatbelts, said that a much more effective and a much more efficient way to regulate people's driving behavior would not be to have seatbelts, but we'd have a 12-inch spike sticking out of the middle of the steering wheel aimed directly at the driver's heart. Okay? Why are you laughing? Makes perfect sense. Why not? Because you're going to drive a whole lot more safely if you've got a 12-inch spike aimed directly at your heart. Are you or are you not? Okay? Gordon Tullock. Okay? Yeah. Two digressions. Some number of years ago, when I was a student here at Mises U, somebody said, David Gordon said, you're not a true libertarian until you've co-authored a paper with Walter Block. Okay? My first refereed publication was co-authored with Walter Block. So, libertarian, check. Okay? It's also been said that your experience as an economist is not complete until you've been insulted by Gordon Tullock. At the 2007 Public Choice Society meetings, I sat with Professor Tullock at dinner. He asked me and another guy a question, and then proceeded to say that we'd be really, really stupid if we couldn't answer it. So, experience as an economist, check. Co-authored with Walter Block, insulted by Gordon Tullock. I was going to say I've got two jewels of the Triple Crown, except I don't know what the other jewel would be. Okay. All right, so, long story short, safety regulation, there's no a priori case for regulation outside of the market process. Okay, who's the third hand that was up? Yeah. Okay, if I can quickly define rent seeking. Okay, it's a great term. So rent seeking Rent seeking is the unproductive expenditure of real resources in order to gain a transfer. So, political competition is rent seeking. Okay? You're spending real resources trying to get the government to take stuff from other people and give it to you. Economic competition is productive. Chick-fil-A competes productively by providing tasty chicken products and waffle fries. They are good. Okay? And an assortment of sauces. Okay? And peach milkshakes. Wow. You want to, oh man, you want to talk about something that'll make you believe in God. Oh, wow. Okay. Peach, the Chick-fil-A peach milkshake is really good. A lot of other people, unfortunately, compete by expropriating and redistributing resources. Defense contractors generally do this. Firms in regulated industries compete by rent seeking. Let's consider two more examples. I remember reading an article a number of years ago about taco stands in Austin, Texas. Never been to Austin. I've heard it's weird and cool and interesting. Okay, but these unlicensed, unregulated taco stands in Austin, Texas, and of course someone was saying, hey, we need to regulate the leader of like the local taco stand union or the leader of the local taco stand association said, we need to regulate taco stands because some of them are unsafe. Some of them are providing unsafe tacos. Okay? And of course, this sounds plausible to a lot of people. Says, and in fact, a lot of people experience a bit of cognitive dissonance. Say, oh, look, these business people who have a common interest are calling for regulation. They must really be great guys and gals. What's left unsaid is that this will protect them from future competition. Pedicabs would be another example. So some cities have pedicabs, which are these like three-wheeled bicycles with seats. So they're bicycle taxis. And of course, the leader of the pedicab association says, we need to regulate for safety. Okay? So, hey, who can be opposed to public safety? Right? And after all, if these guys are saying they should be regulated, they must be really public-spirited. Talked a bit about the Baptist and bootleggers issue. Okay? During Prohibition, the people who supported it were the Baptists, quote-unquote, which was Bruce Yandel's sort of catch-all term for people who think you shouldn't be allowed to drink. The other people who supported it were the bootleggers who got really, really rich as a result. Yes, the bootleggers are the rent seekers. The bootleggers are the rent seekers, and the Baptists are the people who think that, hey, this is a great idea for purposes of public safety. The blue shirt, I saw your hand. One, two, and then, yep.
All right, I used to work at a restaurant, and I know. How would,
No.
Well, not like one.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah. But. People are always worried about food. Mm-hmm. How would a free market the restaurant mind if it's unsanitary, they're not going to be like, hey, just evaluate your kitchen. Have you thought about that before?
Yeah. Okay, so how will the free market handle food safety? Okay, this one's relatively easy, and we've got like 3 minutes left, so I'm not going to take additional comments on this. But, so you have health department reports. Basically, the free market would provide the exact same, would provide something similar. Okay, so you could have Michael Ford from Western Kentucky University. Michael's inspection service. So Michael gives his place an A+ for safety, an A+ for cleanliness. And so the question is, well, what is going to cause Michael to be honest? The answer is the competitive process. Because if he proves untrustworthy, then David might do the same thing. David might say, hey, Michael's a schmuck. He's taking bribes from all these firms, and I'm the honest guy. So he's going to get weeded out of the market. He's going to get weeded out by the market process, and David presumably is going to be the one who persists. Who's the second hand? Pink shirt? Never mind. Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Is it going to be wise to force people to wear seatbelts because it will prevent them from making iterative choices if they die? Okay. So I was totally with you up to that point. The market process is a process of success and failure. You make wise choices, you make bad choices. So the question is, should we regulate in order to prevent people from making bad choices like driving drunk without a seatbelt? Okay? Well, unfortunately, we're about out of time. So my answer is going to be, it's not clear to me, again, that the regulators can have the knowledge they would need to regulate rationally. And in the case of driving, I'm going to punt this one to Walter Block's book on privatizing roads and highways and think hard about how the market process, in a case of, say, privately owned roads, would handle some of these issues. So we're out of time.